Can three collectors agree on one three-watch collection? That is the challenge for today, and to answer it, I have Praka and Vincent here with me. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Do you think it's reasonable for a collector to aim for just a three-watch collection? Or does a serious collector need more than three watches?
I will say yes, mainly because I think three watches in a collection is definitely, it could probably suit your everyday life. A lot of collectors have more than three watches, just mainly just for variety's sake and whether they are focused in their collection. But I think it's having three watches in your collection is enough. And some of the collector only have one or two, and they will still consider as collectors. Mm. But it doesn't mean that you will only have three watches, you only have to watch at one time. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that you cannot change out for those three watches. So I think as you sort of grow and the taste changes, that the three watch collection will gradually turn into something else as well. You know, very different one, different combinations. You know, so meaning have your dress one, you have your sporty one, and you probably have something for a special occasion, things like that. So I think three watches, I think definitely works for most people. Majority of people in this world doesn't have three watches. So
and my,
for a collector,
normal people,
per se, yeah. So we're definitely not on a normal side. So I think three watches for a collection, for a collector, is definitely a, can be done. And I think a lot of people, some collectors do only have three watches.
Ones with discipline and self-control.
Correct. I don't have.
Yeah. You're not one of them.
No, I'm definitely not one of them. I wish I can limit myself to three, but I just can't. Yeah. I think the idea of limiting ourselves to three, you know, and splitting it in the, you know, a dress watch, a dive watch, and an everyday kind of watch or a spinning watch, is good. I think it's great, but for me, I enjoy the variety of being able to pick up different pieces every now and then and go, oh, you know, I haven't worn this in a while. And for me as well, sometimes you get watches that are sentimental, whether it's gifted, whether you get it for this. And if you limit yourself to a three-watch collection, when you have those kind of sentimental pieces as well, I feel like, oh, that's taking up one of three. You know what I mean? And you may not want to wear that all the time, but it still is special to you and it means a lot to you, but you don't want to get rid of it either. So anyway, that's where I'm sort of coming
from. Maybe the three-watch collection doesn't count the sentimental.
Maybe.
Yeah, you can't get rid of those.
That's right.
They mess up the whole concept.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I think the premise of it makes sense. And maybe when you get more refined in your collection, as you're going up in your collection, and maybe many years you've taken your time to curate it, maybe I think the three definitely works.
Absolutely.
But if you sort of early days and you're sort of just working up towards that, for me personally anyway, I don't think
you just want to experience
watches, exactly.
And then you gotta have that very strict discipline, the one in one out, that kind of thing. And it's very, very difficult. In our realm of collecting, but it's just, especially in recent years, I think there's just so many good design and good brands are coming out. And even for the historical brand themselves, they're just for us, so much variety of the collection. The choices on the market right now makes the three watch collection even more difficult. Back in the old days that you have those historical brand, and it might not be such a difficult thing, but right now that you're just so exposed to so many good designs, that to me, it's probably an impossibility. If you're saying that churning down to a collection of 10, maybe that is still doable.
But if we were to do three, probably we would go the cover all bases approach, which is pretty much what we did here.
Mm.
Let's see what we have on the table. Let's start on the dress end.
Okay, let's start on the dress end. So what I have here, it's a recent acquisition of mine, Chrono Tokyo, from the Complication series of the brand, which is a chronograph. So this is chronograph 3. It was named Hisui, Japanese, or you can read Chinese, it actually means jade. So I guess the dial really speaks for itself in terms of the color combination of being white and green. It's a very disciplined piece, I feel. And namely, we're looking at it maybe as a dress piece, it's just because the symmetry, the simplicity, and the purity behind it. If you're in a collecting world, and Chrono Tokyo shouldn't be something and it's strange to you. This brand was started by a Japanese watchmaker, Hajime Asaoka. And he was actually a industrial designer before he was a watchmaker. Other than his own brand, Chrono Tokyo will be probably like the MAP projects from MBNF. Mm-hmm. It's that a more affordable side brand that he basically just designed the watch, but he doesn't actually hand make every piece. So he will use a stock movement from Seiko or from Citizen. So this one particular one runs on the Seiko movement. Basically, he designs the piece, getting someone else to manufacture it, and that will become a more affordable piece to the wider market. So this is my second complication series. The first one I got was the GMT one. And this one is one I've been wearing in the last few weeks. Bit of an inner child from him is that he actually just wanted to design and sort of get his frustration out of it, you know, so he can get this out to the wider market.
It's a very good point you made that this way you get access to Hajime Asaoka in a way that you wouldn't be able to.
Correct.
Because I still get his touch, but you just, you know, when you're a fan of a watchmaker like that,
yeah,
you just want to get your hands on whatever you can.
And you can see the clear difference between his name brand and Chrono.
Yep.
Is that his name brand, obviously the price starting from, you know, 20 grand all the way to 100,000 feels very constrained, very traditional, high complication, obviously. Whereas he's allowed to go with a bit of flair in the Chrono series, that he's got, you know, the Grand series, the Complication series, the Urushi series. He's collaborating with other artists and things like that. So you can definitely reach out to the wider artistic industry as well. So I think that this sort of led him to have a lot more play in his design as well, and also to experiment.
And like you mentioned, MBNF, I think this is where the idea kind of comes from, because Chrono predates the Med One series. That's why I think the Med One is popular, because people want MBNF on their wrist, but it's not easy.
It's something to do,
and the Med One makes it possible. And I'm seeing it more and more, because, for example, Andreas Treller, who I hold in great regard, just started his accessible brand. It's still an in-house movement, so not this accessible, but it's still not the handmade $100,000 piece that he normally makes.
Yep.
So I think it's sort of a trend, and other watchmakers see it as a possibility of extending their reach to like lower tiers.
Do you find that more independent brands like what you just mentioned and Hajime Asaoka, do you think that's trickled down to the traditional brands, like looking at Omega and the Moon Swatch and, you know, the Blancpain and Swatch collabs and stuff? You know, you're trying to get the accessibility to the brand at a much lower price point than what it traditionally would and gives people the flavor. Obviously, this is more an enthusiast side, I guess a layman might go, yeah, Omega. I know Omega. Moonswatch. That looks cool.
Yeah.
Boom. Yeah, it's a very good point. Obviously, more about the brand because there's no watchmaker behind it.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
But yeah.
Good point. Yeah, no. Having those brands on the market doesn't necessarily take anything away from the historical brands at all. And obviously, yes, that unless you're really in the collecting world or enthusiasts, you wouldn't know about those brands. And a lot of time, they don't really have any brick and mortar stores and to promote themselves. And to purchase one of those, they actually do have to be online and sit on the computer, just like you're buying a concert ticket. Probably not as hard as getting a Taylor Swift ticket, but
you still have to be
there on time and click away, and because you'll be gone in 10 minutes, basically.
And we're curious how we will feel about this trend when the first plastic bracket comes out.
Yeah,
I'm not looking forward to that.
Even though those really high-end watchmakers that comes up with their own little micro brand, it still pays a lot of attention to quality, to details, to design. What I love about this watch is definitely you have to look at it under a microscope and attention to detail, the color schemes and the texture on the dial.
Particularly for this type of piece, it's very much on the dial design. And obviously what the cost is cut for, you know, touching the movements.
Color came in the last few years into the watch world, I think.
In a big way.
My feeling is that it has something to do with the prevalence of watch collecting, because when you start
with a watch, you're not going to go for crazy colors. You go black or white, maybe blue if you're crazy.
Gray or something, very restrained tradition.
When you go through a few watches, you start looking for interesting things.
Yeah.
And, you know, the pop color on the dial is one of those things. So I think it's more about, you know, prevalence of a watch collecting as a mainstream hobby.
Yeah. It's hard to say who actually started off, you know. So, I mean, there's a lot of vintage watches that has a lot of color. If you're talking about radio dials, and recently I think that the most recognizable will be the Mosers, you know, so the rhythm dial.
But having Rolex makes so many color dials.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mainstream. And when I was
living in Shanghai, I collected a lot of Chinese watches. Mm. And they're from the 70s. And their color dials are extremely similar to what they have.
Yeah, the 70s had some really cool, like, dials. Or, I mean, I think the 70s in general, the era, doesn't matter, not just watches, right? Yeah, it was funky. It was really cool, like, you know, chronographs and Sega chronographs. Even they were, that exactly, they had all these different colors.
And it all went downhill in the 80s, right?
Exactly.
But I mean, it's interesting to see how sort of things to sort of coming waves.
Yes, you know? But the point of difference is such a big factor, I believe, especially for micro brands and, you know, like this Corona as well. It's a point of difference.
Yes.
There are many chronographs in the market with a Seiko movement. And
absolutely.
Stuff,
yeah.
What's different about it? What makes it so unique? And
that's
what you've just gone through now. And it's like, oh yeah, I can see that, and that adds to the value of, you know, watch.
And actually, I was in Japan earlier this month, and I was thinking that should I actually inform the shop to actually pick this up myself, and especially like email them and message them through Instagram. And unfortunately, the shop told me that yes, the shop will be open on the 4th, but Hajime Yosaka won't be there himself because he was still on leave. I was really keen to go there and see some of the discontinued pieces
that would be
in the
cool
store, and that would be really cool. We call this our dress watch in the collection.
Sure.
But it is a chronograph, though.
Yes.
Is that appropriate to have a chronograph? Or because of the size and the case shape, and it's a leather strap?
Yep, leather strap.
We're okay with it being a dress watch?
I mean, the dimension of this is 38 mil, but it is on a thick side of 13 millimeter.
Surely.
Would you consider this as a dress watch?
I think so. I mean, in a collection like this, obviously we're going to go through each of these watches. I think that's definitely the dress watch for me. Yes, it has a complication, but, you know, some of these awesome 60s chronographs and stuff like that, they look very, you know, dressy, especially like some gold pieces and stuff like that. And that's what this reminds me of. It's very vintage styling, very, and that's why I think we can, you know, call it a dress piece. But I get what you mean. Should a dress watch just be simple, three-hander? But I think this is elegant.
I mean, how do you define a dress watch? That's the thing, right? So
a lot of people wear divers with suits nowadays.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
That's right. Yeah.
If you go into an office.
And Bond.
Yeah. You wear it with a tuxedo.
Yeah. Actually, I was listening to a podcast the other day, and one of the guys mentioned how he was annoyed at the fact that anything from a certain era, say the 50s or something, or inspired from that era, from nowadays would just be called dress watches, right? But back then, it's a watch because that was the style.
Yeah,
I mean, almost every watch was like that. It didn't matter
if it's Seamasters.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a Seamaster. That's not a, you know.
Yeah.
But nowadays, you know, Seamaster is a different watch. So anyway, I just thought it was a very interesting thing to think about. You're like, oh yeah, so dress watch really.
Anything. Yeah, absolutely. I think it also has to do with the complication as well, particularly for this one, let's say, because if you're talking about complication, chronograph has a very sporty connotation to it because it's related to racing or Speedmaster. It's a moon watch, or you're talking about the Hoyers, you know, they're race watches. So I think particularly for chronograph, it's a little hard for people to think
as a dress watch,
but maybe for some other complications. For example, you can probably have perpetual calendar that can be very much a dress watch. So I don't think that complication has necessarily to do with how would you see a watch with a dress watch or not.
What if we need something that can be beat up a bit, or at least can go swimming?
That will survive a shower or a hand wash.
Yeah.
As much as it's been done. So yes, we're talking about, I guess, a diver or a beta or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, this is Seiko SPB-143J, which is a recreation of Seiko's very first dive watch, the 62MAS. Basically visually identical with a few changes, of course, the Prospex X logo and et cetera.
Yep.
Which is, I don't know, you know, a lot of people feel funny about that. It's a perfect dive watch for me. It's, you know, ISO rated 200 meter water resistance. It's, you know, it does it all. It's got a date window in it, which some people like, don't like in a dive watch, but I think it's unique. And it just goes with anything. Like I wear on a bracelet, I wear on a rubber strap, I wear on this gray NATO that I've got on here. I think it pairs really well. And, you know, I even can take this NATO out to the beach. It's not a big issue. I can wear it with pretty much anything, including, like you said, the beach, the you know, going in the bush, you know, in the bath with my kids.
Yeah, it works. Like, go anywhere, do anything.
Please. Exactly. Yeah. You can do that with this. I even worn this in a wedding before when I said, yeah, you know.
Maybe not a NATO.
No, it wasn't an arrow. it was on a bracelet. Yeah. but it can be done if you really want. Yeah. The dive watch is essential if you're going to go for a three watch collection. I know, you know, I wouldn't limit myself to three watch collection, yeah. but I think it you know, it's essential. A dive watch like this has a lot of history as well. The model is quite new, but where the inspiration and I guess the recreation of it was Seiko's very first dive watch. It came, I think, a couple of years after the Submariner and the Blancpain 50 Fathoms and stuff. So it's got a lot of provenance. Personally, this watch means a lot to me as well. This was the watch that was given to me by my wife, my parents, my friends, my family for my 30th birthday.
Oh,
so,
wow.
It's my most, you know, significant piece in my collection.
So it's a keeper.
Definitely a keeper. Yes, correct. So sure. One of those ones where, you know, I got a gift and, you know, I'm not going to wear it. No, it's definitely, you know, I rotate it and use it all the time. It's still one of my favorites. I've had many watches come and go, but this will never go in my collection. Having a dive watch, you know, as part of a watch collection is essential. And even though you don't dive, or 99% of the population doesn't dive, unless you're talking about commercial divers and recreational divers, I find that, you know, I think the most I've been as deep as the, you know, 1.8 meters or 2 meters, 2 meter water depth at the end of the pool, that's about it. Yeah, or maybe a beach sometime. But to be ability to have it, you know, to be able to do it is great,
and not have to worry about it, basically while you take it down into the water, you know, so worry free timepiece.
Exactly. And it comes with the, you know, all the dire shock protection. Comes with the anti-magnetic stuff in there as well. So it's robust, you know.
I mean, for, Seiko's, then, I mean, they have a pretty long history in terms of making dive watches. And the recreation for 62 Mas kind of blew up the market when it first came out.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that the first model that sort of cost $6,000 or something.
Yes. You're bang on right. I mean, you spoke about it before. Having that accessibility point level, and this is one of those things. I think they've had about three iterations of this re-releases. And like we talked about robustness and stuff, you know, Seiko Divers has been on people that dive in the military in Vietnam, and you know they wore different models. They wore the Willard and Turtles and things like that. But you know, the robustness of a Seiko Diver is proven nowadays, probably all G-Shocks, I would think. Back then, that was the choice of someone wearing...
Military divers.
Military divers, exactly. They were solid, well-built, and to this day...
Willer was in Apocalypse Now, isn't it?
Correct, that's it, That's my pick for the three-watch collection.
Strong pick. And like I said, it covers that base that needs to be covered if you're talking about the watch collection. With a three-watch collection, you want to be versatile. You want to make sure you're covered for everything. But when you go pick up a new watch, do you look at specs? Do you look at design? Or do you look at heritage? What's most important for you?
I think first and foremost is the design, like an aesthetic. If I want to look at the time, I can check my flight. Nine times out of 10, it's an issue. Yes, it's nice to have a new wrist and look at it, but specs probably comes second, I would say, or third even in some cases. But the looks, the design definitely needs to speak to me. I would then probably put proportions, just because I have a smaller wrist than average. I really look at the proportion.
The sizing.
I have watches that are bigger, watches that are smaller, but you know, 38 mil like that for me,
perfect.
You know, even this 40.5 mil diameter, but Seiko diamonds, always have really compact lug to lug.
Yeah.
So you can wear it. And then probably specs right at the end. Mm. Like, I mean, the movement in this, the stated tolerances is...
not worth mentioning.
Exactly. No. It's not great. I've lucked out, I guess, in my sort of wear. It's not too bad. It's pretty, you know.
Who's counting, right?
So. Exactly. Yeah, and especially when it's part of a wider collection.
But it's not the movement's fault. I'm guessing you could regulate it if you wanted to.
Yes,
it's
correct.
But it's just a matter of cost.
Exactly. Yeah, the amount of hand finishing in this is probably next to none. Mm. That's the real truth of it. I mean, a lot of this stuff is really precision machinery, like a house like Seiko.
Yeah,
they have. Everything. They do everything, right?
Yeah.
From start to finish.
It's a vertical integrated
company. For them to have that little bit of pen regulation at the end, probably not worth it for them. But in saying that, you know, other small micro brands and everything do that.
Yep.
And you get the 62 Massa. Yeah, a bit more.
Yeah, that's it, just to get it regulated. Yeah. So I might do at some point, but to be honest, it doesn't bother me. And like I said, it's a diver. The beta, it is my everyday, can be my everyday for me. If it's out, you know, a little bit out of the spec, doesn't bother me.
So what do you say? But I mean, I'm guessing design is very important.
Definitely, I think design would definitely be at the absolute first for the exact same reason. I have to look at it, you know. Yep. So, I think we're very visual animals, and I think the design first of all has to resonate with me first.
Sure.
Whereas in terms of movement accuracy, I can understand why a lot of people put so much emphasis on it. And in terms of the in-house movement, the accuracy of it, only really came out as a big topic in the last 10-15 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, but I mean, that traditionally how a company makes watches, they always use movement from other companies, supply movements from other companies. They never really used to do their own movements.
Yeah.
I think this perspective of in-house movement being prestigious is only sort of came about in the last decade or so. So for me, is that it's not so much of an issue.
Only probably lasts until the first service. Yeah, then you're not so keen on in-house anymore.
Yeah, that's right. There's only two guys in this world that can service your watch.
Yeah. Do you think it's a marketing thing, a lot of it? Like, you know, the whole in-house movement. I mean, Citizen and Seiko are in-house movements.
Precisely.
Some of their movements cost $20-$30. I mean, this is... So what does it actually mean? Like how
that's
much
right.
weight are we putting towards it?
Yeah. I think the point is that it doesn't mean anything.
Because
in-house Patek is different from an in-house Citizen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, that's it. Mm. You know, so every Citizen watch has in-house movement, basically. People conceive Chinese brands as, you know, cheap watches, but they're, you know, the seagulls, they do their own movement.
Yeah.
And then they bought off Vita's machinery to make their movements.
When it comes to in-house, there's one criteria. Is that where was it designed? Some of the seagulls are just copies.
Yeah. They're clones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then how would you perceive a Sellita movement?
Sellita was set up by ETA to produce ETA clones.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have the manufacturing capacity.
Mm.
I think the problem sometimes with in-house is who designed it and how. An in-house movement that was put in like two watches.
There's so many things can go wrong with them.
So many things can go wrong. Yeah.
The things that
you don't want to be the one that finds out.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
They haven't really stood the test of time.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Whereas some of the... Yeah.
And especially with complications, it just bumps it up to another level.
That's it.
I'm only, it's not that difficult to get right.
Yeah.
Chronograph.
Yeah.
It's a very underrated complication. I went through a lot of watches over the years, and I try to have fewer, but... want to make sure that every one of them feels special. And this one is one of those pieces. I thought it would round out nicely our Japanese-themed collection. An all-rounder, usually wear it on a strap.
Mm.
Not that there's anything wrong with the bracelet. Well, it's not true. There's something wrong with the bracelet. But people give Grand Seiko bracelets a hard time, with good reason. This bracelet is very, very solid.
Mm.
The finishing is exceptional. It feels... very solid. The clasp is a big letdown.
Yep.
Especially, I have a larger wrist, which can swell quite a bit.
Yeah, see.
And having no micro adjustment whatsoever is a pain.
Mm.
So I just prefer it on the strap. Plus, it barely tapers. So
yeah.
especially with the smaller case, which I appreciate because a lot of rent cycles still are quite chunky.
This
one is a smaller case and slimmer as well. So this is the SLGH-003. Mm-hmm. It was a limited edition when this 9S85 movement was released. I like good movements. This is not my first Grand Seiko one, but when this came out, I was just taken with this movement. It's a nice machine finish, on par with many high-end Swiss watches, but the architecture is just so pretty. It's a double barrel, full balance bridge, and the layout of the movement, it just makes it good looking. A lot of other movements the Grand Seiko makes are similarly well finished, but don't look as good. I just like to see it.
Yeah,
it has a bit of Zales polishing on the case. Obviously, Zales polishing was not invented by...
It's in the German,
Grand Seiko. It's German.
Yeah.
As far as I know, it takes about 3 years for a polisher to train up to the level where they can actually finish the case. So you don't want to scratch up your Grand Seiko.
It's
going to be hard to refinish.
Yes.
This is not all polished, so it's mostly brushed on the sides, but these chamfers are... the famous Zales polish, but for me it's the dial furniture that sells me on this watch and most Grand Seiko. And I have some nice watches, but this is on par or better than anything I've ever seen. Like
that's a massive statement from your collection.
I've compared it to much more expensive watches, and this holds up. Obviously, the movement is machine finish, nice, but you can get it elsewhere. The case finishing, Zalats. It's pretty, but you can still get it. But this sort of dial furniture, you can't get it, even in high-end brands. It's, for me, it's amazing. And I put a loop on these markers. It's just amazing. The perfect polishing, the angles, the little striation on top.
Definitely.
That makes it very, very special. Most Grand Seikos are like that.
Yeah.
And I appreciate it. I don't think that... it's mentioned enough. How incredible that part of the watch is.
Yeah, I think a lot of people credit the, you know, like he says, the Zeratsu polish.
They're talking about dials. At most, dial texture, which is nice.
Yeah.
But those markers, the hands.
Yes, definitely a lot of detail you can only see under them.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, I was, you know, even the movement, that was gorgeous as well.
It looks pretty. So you can see that they put some thought into the design, the layout.
Lots of it. What I find really interesting is just the DNA. You can see the DNA that's carrying through, and that's super cool. To be honest, I didn't notice it until you were carrying it, just obviously to another level, but it's absolutely cool.
Well, they're charging for it. So.
Yeah. that's fair. That's completely fair.
Yeah. So for me, like I said, it doesn't matter how much a watch costs, because anything above $50 Casio is luxury.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't need
necessity.
It. So it has to feel special when I put it on. Yeah, and this one does. That's why it has a place in my collection, I think. It rounds out this three watch collection quite nicely. It's versatile. You can dress it up with a strap, but even on the bracelet, it's wearable with anything.
Also, the all-rounder, I say.
Yeah, it's a sporty case, like you said, but it doesn't feel like a sports watch.
It's cool how the that grammar of design, also you can see it, you know, with the indices and everything else as well. All that real sharp indices, you know, the old gem cut style coming through.
The bevelings,
and everything showing through enough. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and it's actually really typical for a watch to make it into your collections as well, you know. So if you have a pretty stringent, mostly dependent collection.
I went through quite a few watches. I learned that just because I appreciate a watch doesn't mean I have to own it.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
I only want to own pieces that I wear.
Yeah.
That's important for me. And when you went through a few years of condensation, you get to pieces that are very hard to let go of.
You develop a lot of emotion on some of the pieces over time.
What gives you more enjoyment in the watch collecting hobby? Buying a new piece, getting that endorphin rush, or owning and collecting memories with it?
I think for me, it's definitely the chase, looking at a piece and the hunt. It's like when you're buying something on eBay, you're expecting the box. Isn't it? It's that type of feeling. Seeing a really good design that resonates with your taste definitely gives me the most pleasure. And once I receive the watch, and obviously it depends on, because sometimes you don't get to see it before you buy it. And sometimes it does feel a bit of a letdown afterwards. Mm-hmm. There are some watches I got, I didn't quite like it in the very beginning, sure. But it, over time, it really grew on me, definitely in the initial taste of it.
That's
quite exhilarating.
Yeah, and I'm with you there as well. I think the chase or the, you know, trying to find it, and especially like you mentioned, a lot of the watches that I get as well is like in the micro brand space or something. So I can't just go down to the shop and go buy one. It's always unseen. You know, you bought unseen 9 times out of 10. You're just watching videos, you're reading reviews, you're looking at spec, you're looking at proportions, and you're like, okay, this is going to work. I'm going to love this. And then it comes. And then sometimes you're like, yes, this is exactly what I wanted. My Helios, like I was like, yep, this is perfect. But I have received many watches. I'm like, oh, yeah, I don't know about this. And initially, I try my best not to tell myself that because I don't want to feel disappointed at how I spend it. But yeah, some stay around the collection, some go. And that's how I learn. That's, you know, you learn, and like you said, to build up your collection, you might have to experience the different types of watches or different watches, and you go, oh, this is actually not for me. And then you move it on.
Where does the disappointment come from? The watch doesn't live up to the expectations, or you just don't like it on the wrist?
No, I think, watch doesn't live up to the expectations is one thing. How it wears on the wrist, I can sort of tune that a bit better now because I'm aware of the dimensions that work for me. Now, initially, not really. I was just buying, oh, that looks good, I'll get it. More and more being, okay, no, I need to actually check the dimensions. But in saying that, you can get the perfect dimensions and then you chuck it on your wrist and you go, I don't like the way it looks.
So would you be happy with this collection if you owned it? Let's say you're only allowed 3 watches.
Okay. Yes. For me, yes, 100%. It covers all bases for me. I would look at this as like an everyday wearer, a sports watch, but it's obviously I'm not going to take it out to the beach or I'm not going to, you know, do rough stuff with it. I'll leave that for this. And then, you know, for the special occasions where I can bring that to a wedding or, you know, to the office, and you can rotate between the two. Doesn't necessarily have to be one or the other. And same with this as well, if I just change up a strap. So I think very well balanced.
And they're very versatile pieces as well. It's that you can, all three of them can actually be sports watch and all three of them can be dressy watches as well. It's I think in terms of the availability of different straps, to change up things, it's incredible. Changing strap is like you can make the watch look like a complete different piece.
Yeah, agree. Would you change anything about this? Like say for just, you know, looking at it like this, would you try and add more color? Would you try and have less?
I think we're good with color because we've got blue, green, and black. We went with the Japanese theme.
We did. Yeah.
So that would be weird for me to have only Japanese watches.
It's true.
I'm a bit of a variety collector, so I like different colors, different makes, different brands, different countries. So that would bother me, but that's nonsense. Because if I look at it, as in, are the bases covered? Like you said, they are. I think it works as a 3-watch collection,
and I think it's a very sort of bang for the buck collection as well. It's like you got your daily beaters and you got your special watches and you got your high end sort of movements that, you know, really well.
Yeah, like every one of these watches are great for money. Even the Grand Seiko, okay, it's a bit more expensive, but for what you get in a Swiss, you would pay twice as much.
The attention to detail, the accuracy, the discipline behind the brand is just unmatched.
With all these machine made watches, something that was touched by a human makes it a bit more special. The same with the Kurano. Hajime Asaoka maybe only contributed some of the design cues, maybe picked a color. We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know exactly how actually much he did involve into it.
Yeah, but it makes it a bit more special. It's connected to a person.
And obviously, he's got a workshop in Tokyo, and he did open a brick and mortar store in Tokyo as well, so he's there sometimes. So he does look after his brand, and he's something that, like I say, it's more of his inner child that he wants that part of the watchmaking to be fun, you know, rather than sitting in his basement doing the hand finishing
all day long. So it's definitely his pet project.
And I think with your Seiko Diver, it comes back to heritage and history. And like, I think Seiko is really underappreciated outside of Japan. It has a lot more history than Rolex
or most of brands,
something like that.
1881 or something, that's just off the top of my head. But yeah, the history is unmatched. You know, I mean, there's so many brands out there with history, and they've got the history too. I think it doesn't help, obviously, that the different tiers that they have, they sort of try and capture from, you know, from the shopping small watches all the way up to, you know, your Cradles and your Seikos and everything else. You know, you got some really high end stuff as well. So they try and catch all, and that's why I think sort of, you know, gives them that.
I think you're right. I think maybe for a brand to have too much of a collection can be a negative thing for them, because they are an integrated company. They produce everything in house. They can do it from 150 SKS all the way to a Creedor. You know, most people don't know about Creedors, and they're, you know, $130,000 watches. And you can't get one if you have
a hand-painted porcelain.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Yeah. And it's just inconceivable of how a company can actually create something from so accessible to so exclusive.
Yeah.
And I think the perception to the market is that I want to have offering for all kinds of people.
Yeah.
And so maybe some Swiss brands that they're very targeted to a certain audience as well. So
I think that's what held back Grand Seiko for a long time, the 8-set Seiko on the dial.
It did. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, and the double logo. Yeah. Brand perception is
correct.
See, brand perception matters. Yeah. As much as we want to pretend that it doesn't, it does.
It does.
For most of it, actually. Yeah, for every single brand out there. It's in history, your perception in the market. And so a brand can have a very good reputation one day, and next day, you know, some news comes out, the price drops. It's incredible.
Yeah, you've seen that. In-house turned out to be not in-house.
That's it. You know, so there are brands that will claim to be in-house, but exactly how we or the overall market perceives that brand to be, you know, so.
And how transparent the brand is.
Mm.
I love independence, but they don't claim to make everything under one roof.
Correct.
Does it devalue the brand? No. Lying about it does.
Correct.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a really good shift that we're seeing. Especially like independents, even micro brands, they're coming out and they say, yep, my cases are made in Hong Kong. My dial is made here. My movement is made in Switzerland, and we assemble them in France. You know,
and like Baltic is such a popular brand.
Correct.
And even the designs, I love
how you picked up Baltic cigarette.
Isn't it? Yeah. I think we're all thinking about Baltic. You just said it.
Well, you said trash.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But even the designs are not exactly original.
No. It's taken
no
from
one
the
gives them a hard time because they put out a product that's good.
Yeah.
That's proportional to value because, you know, there are other brands that are priced very high, and they get a hard time because the price is not proportional to what you're getting.
Yeah. Yep. They're a reasonable price, they're good-looking watches, they're very transparent about how they're made.
Yeah. So you get the choice and not second-guess the brand as to what the true
origin. Yeah, but we don't have to, you have a look at Swiss made. How much of it is actually made in Switzerland? Yeah, I mean, I don't want to open up that topic yet.
That's
probably another discussion. But that's the facts, is that there is just, you know, look at Tissot or Tag or someone. The amount of volume of watches they sell versus how many people they actually have in terms of watchmakers to actually do it. Numbers don't add up, and that's, you know, and they don't come out and say like independents do. Yeah, I get my parts from here. Or I get this from there. But because people want that perception, that luxury. You know, I'm buying a Swiss-made product. This is luxurious. But the reality is, it doesn't matter that parts of it was made in Asia because the quality is still there. It doesn't diminish the quality of your product. It doesn't diminish it. It's just the perception.
Yeah. That's it. Then again, made in Asia doesn't mean one thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's levels.
Exactly.
Manufacturing, just like in Switzerland.
Yes.
Correct.
With this in-house and sourcing parts, like, would you really want a brand to make everything in-house? You wouldn't. You want to find the people who are best at the
parts. Correct, yeah.
These parts, like a case, a movement, or hands, or dial, is a specialist job. You want people who are the best. Okay, if you're Rolex, you can employ thousands upon thousands of people and
get the best machinery. But if you make, you know, 1,000 watches a year, you're not going to be able to buy a 5-axis CNC machine.
Yeah.
And run it all year because it's going to run for 2 weeks and then just sit in there. So it's much better to get the people who specialize in it and just order the parts. And that's how Switzerland works.
Yeah, that's how usually traditionally the company procure watches. You're not trying to be the best of everything, but you take the best from different field and put it together. Yeah. You know, so.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having
us. I think we did well.
I think so too.
I think so. It's a good thing if we're just sticking with a Japanese brand, Japanese watch. I think this is a definitely a really good three watch collection.
Although I expected Praka to bring a Credor.
Yeah, maybe next time.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for the chat. See you next time.